Ghoulish greetings, my blood donors. The tunes are courtesy of the lovely Bobby Mackey. And I'm, of course, your host, Tessa Morrow. Now today it's a different place, all the same with a new face, with strange mysteries hanging in the air. People in their sane minds swear they see you today. Are you looking for the love they took away? Everyone knows that you couldn't bear the pain, so you took your life in the pouring rain. Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers Podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift, whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from high up in the mountains to chilling in the water on a boat, from desolate desert to the biggest of cities, and everything in between, it is greatly appreciated.
Round of applause. This week's city shout-out goes to
Bridgeport, Connecticut, West Point, New York, Eigelshoven, the Netherlands, Juarez, Mexico, Simpsonville, South Carolina, and Leicester, England. So, this past week has definitely been an eventful one for me, and one that really wasn't planned. So, my friend Teresa, you heard from her in one of my Rock or Death episodes, maybe even two of them, and on a Halloween episode. Well, she reached out to me asking if I happened to like Shinedown, the band, and I, of course, said, hell yes. And she proceeded to gift me, for my birthday, a Shinedown ticket. And so we went to that on August 12th in Denver at the Ball Arena. And we had such a great, epic time, you guys. Morgan Wade, somebody I had never even heard of before, was an opening act. She's like rock slash country, if you will. And it was pretty badass, actually. It was awesome. I liked it. And then Bush came on afterwards. I grew up listening to Bush. Loved it. And so that was pretty awesome. And let's just say that we were in the pit area. And that, to put a picture in your heads, it was the stage, the railing, barrier, one person in front of us, and then it was us. And we were that close. It was utterly epic. I even got a picture of Gavin Rosdell looking right at me. So, pretty badass, if I do say so myself. Played some of their classics like Glycerine, Everything Zen, Swallowed, Machine Head. You get the drift. And then Shinedown was obviously the main act. And they were blow you out of the water terrific. Playing several songs, including 45, Planet Zero, Monsters, and my absolute favorites, Sound of Madness, and Fly from the Inside. Oldie, but absolute goodie. I had actually gone to 21 Pilots with her and my aunt last year. And then Godsmack last year, too. That was a birthday present from my amazing Aunt Rhonda. The music adventure keeps on going as just literally 2 days later, after Shinedown and Bush and Morgan Wade, on August 15th, we went to go back to the Ball Arena to go watch Nine Inch Nails. Oh my God. And we got there pretty early, actually. So we were in the pit again. And we got to get right up to the barrier fencing area. So like literally there was nobody in front of us. Except for security, of course. Now, they had two different stages for Nine Inch Nails, so they were kind of going back and forth. And so, obviously, when they were on the other stage, we didn't have that front row view, but it was pretty badass, to say the least. The opening act was some techno turntable dude, really not my cup of tea, so we were super, super stoked, obviously, when Trent Reznor finally gets on the stage. We had just had Liquid Death, Sparkling Water, that kicks ass. And it was prior to the concert, obviously. And I always love the Murder Your Thirst, Recycle Your Soul, that's inscribed on their cans. So I had a kid around saying that techno turntable dude murdered our thirst, but Trent Reznor, oh man, baby, he was there to revive and recycle our souls. And no offense for people who like that kind of thing, the turntables. It's just never been for me. And listening to it for an hour, I was like, But you know what? It was an epic day. Wouldn't change it for anything. So performed by Nine Inch Nails were some of my favorites and the most popular. Closer, The Hand That Feeds, Hurt, and just so many other songs, obviously. Just had to let you know how my week was going so far. So here we go. Now on for the episode. We are Cemetery Trippin', my friends. Part 2 Cemetery Trippin' begins in 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Ha ha! First up on my list is Precious Blood Cemetery, only 2 blocks away from Oak Hill Cemetery. While a good portion of this burial ground is actually in the town of Blackstone, Massachusetts, it is considered to be in Woonsocket, Rhode Island. The 51st governor of Rhode Island, 7 terms by the way, which is pretty damn impressive in my book, Aram Pothier, rests here for all eternity, his mausoleum being the largest here, and over 24,000 souls call this burial ground their forever home. Mid-August of 1955, major damage comes a-knockin' at the cemetery when Hurricane Diane barrels through the area. She was a brutal force not to be reckoned with. Hurricane Diane, in her wake, would leave close to 200 dead, causing anywhere from $832 million to $1 billion worth of damages, making it the costliest hurricane in United States history. That is until Hurricane Betsy showed her ugly old face in 1965, 10 years later, responsible for 81 deaths. But while Diane had Betsy beat in deaths, Betsy had over $1 billion in damages, over $1.4 billion. Woonsocket, Rhode Island, it was heavily damaged as a dam broke to the northwest of the city, pushing a 20-foot wall of water down the Blackstone River. That would have been terrifying. Precious Blood Cemetery experiences horrific flooding, and yeah, any guesses of what can happen to a burial ground when flooding occurs? It's like something out of a scary movie, like one of those old black and white horror classics. Rising caskets. New Orleans was seeing that all the time. Several came up to the surface. It was something out of a, again, scary movie. Floating caskets in the flooded streets. And while many were located, collected, and reburied, some found their way out to the ocean, sadly, never to be seen again. People who've come here have captured EVPs. Some have seen unexplained lights floating throughout the cemetery grounds. And meanwhile, more than a few ears were lucky enough to hear disembodied voices while nobody else was near them. The spirits seem somewhat restless, perhaps roaming about, looking for their burials, being disrupted with that pesky hurricane. And yeah, I am a wimposaurus and a half when it comes to hurricanes. That's why I'm not in North Carolina right now. Am I worried about it? Yeah, I'm always concerned that one of these years, I'm not going to come back to a house. But I'm one of those people that under pressure like that, I do not do good. I think I might have mentioned it before, but like when I was in Hawaii, I was there for like a week and I came back. And I think it was like 2 days later, they were hit with all these like warnings of tsunamis. And I was like, wow, I'd be the person in the corner in a fetal position crying your eyes out. Yeah. I don't do good. So my heart always does go out to people and animals and homes and businesses that are affected when it comes to Mother Nature throwing a tantrum. You know, flooding, like those horrific Texas floods, you know, hurricanes, you know, and a few are brewing right now going through the Atlantic. Tornadoes. It's just very, very sad. So keeping everybody that is in the storm's paths in my thoughts and prayers. Absolutely. Next up on my good old cemetery trippin' list is Keystone Cemetery, which takes us to the Black Hills of South Dakota. That's a state I've never been to. I've always wanted to go check it out. Keystone, also known as Mountain View Cemetery, has burials dating back to the late 1880s. The number of folks who rest here is on the smaller side, in the upper 400s, and a plaque welcomes visitors. Local historians have a field day with the cemetery. David N. Swansea is interred here. Swansea was a friend of Charles Rushmore and Gutzon Borglum, and was involved with the naming of Mount Rushmore, and married Carrie Ingalls of Little House on the Prairie. One of the most impressive markers is that of Wild Horse Harry Hardin. He posed as a bearded prospector with his donkey, Sugar Babe, and his makeup character was used to advertise Landstrom's Black Hills gold jewelry. He told the visitors that he was a survivor of the Custer Massacre. Unfortunately, his marker indicates he was born in 1896, 20 years after General George Armstrong Custer was killed at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. David Swansea's son, Harold David Davy Red Swansea, was a worker at Mount Rushmore National Memorial. Now, usghostadventures.com shares more interesting information and history when it comes to Keystone, or what I like to call Mountain View, because that's more appropriate for the cemetery, and you'll find out soon. It's the only cemetery in the world with a picturesque view of Mount Rushmore. Yeah, talk about Mountain View, my friends. Sorry, had to add that part in. Originally part of the Harvey National Forest, Keystone Cemetery was deeded to the modern Woodmen of America. In 1900, Patrick Hayes, a member of the club, laid out the boundaries of the would-be graveyard. Tragically, the first burial was that of his daughter, 18-month-old Catherine. She was initially laid to rest at Harney Cemetery, which was abandoned that same year. The boundaries of Keystone Cemetery from above resemble an old wooden coffin. However, Mr. Hayes didn't plan for that. It seemingly just happened by chance and was determined by the natural terrain of the land. Many of the men who helped construct Mount Rushmore rest here for all time. The cemetery that has the view of Mount Rushmore is believed to be one of the most haunted locations in the state of South Dakota. People who have visited this burial ground have experienced photographic evidence, electronics just going haywire, and much more. And for a place who's considered to be one of the most haunted, I really wasn't able to find much during my research, so I really don't know. I guess time will tell. I may have to go and check it out for myself one of these days. We now leave South Dakota and head up Texas. Enter Baby Head Cemetery, which was designated a recorded Texas historic landmark in 1991, which, by the way, is the absolute highest honor the amazing state of Texas can give to a historic location. So, Baby Head Cemetery for the win. Now, you know, this has to be the weirdest name for a cemetery that I have ever heard. Baby Head Cemetery. The story behind it is disturbing. A sign welcomes guests. According to local oral tradition, the name Baby Head was given to the mountain in this area in the 1850s when a small child was killed by Native Americans in the United States, and its remains left on the mountain. A local creek also carried the name, and a pioneer community founded in the 1870s became known as Babyhead. The oldest documented grave here is that of another child, Jody Mae McNeely, on New Year's Day, 1884. The cemetery is the last physical reminder of Babyhead community, which once had numerous farms, homes, and businesses. So TexasHillCountry.com talks more about the now extinct town of Babyhead and the cemetery. Quote, Babyhead Cemetery can be found approximately 10 miles north of Llano in the Texas Hill Country. It's the only thing remaining in the area that marks where a flourishing 19th century town once stood. The story behind its spooky moniker is said to have its origins in the finding of an infant skull on the very same land, also referred to as Babyhead Mountain. The town, which developed at the site in the late 1800s grew to house a few businesses, a post office, and a school. However, by 1968, there were only 20 residents remaining. Sadly, as well as quite eerily, the only thing left behind to ever indicate its existence is a historical marker and Babyhead Cemetery. Today, all that remains of the settlement is Babyhead Cemetery. It's the final resting place for a few dozen, with some being as recent as the year 2000. Although the cemetery is still visited by those in mourning of loved ones, paying them care and attention after they've passed, it's not uncommon to see baby doll heads hanging from the sign. Unquote. Now, supposedly, the baby's head was placed on a stake and left in the mountains. And I mean, people know people, generations of people, like, oh, like, I know this guy, he worked for somebody who actually searched for the child. And so I wouldn't say this is really a legend. I don't really know the name of the child, but it is believed that a child was killed and that its head was left on a stake and left in the mountains somewhere. So that is really, really sad, obviously, very heartbreaking if any part of that is true. I did see a photo online bearing three small headstones, which each had the title Baby Girl, and the death dates were 1931, 1939, and 1943. Each decorated with, you guessed it, a baby doll's head. Really just an eerie tone for sure. The final burial ground for this episode takes us to Jasper County in Missouri. Peace Church Cemetery. Or sometimes referred to as Peace Cemetery, as the Peace Church is no longer there. The cemetery dates back to 1841, making it the second oldest cemetery in Jasper County. Close to 2,000 people rest here eternally. Several veterans are buried here, vets from the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korean War, and the Battle of Carthage. So, a ton of different vets. Very precious, precious vets. The first recorded burial would take place in 1846 when a local woman would sadly die during childbirth, unsure of the baby's fate. Hopefully it survived and was able to live a good life. A notorious psychopath calls this cemetery his forever home. A spree killer and mass murderer named William Edward Cook Jr., but he was better known as Billy. Now, many visitors have seen a shadow figure of a man here, and many believe it to be Billy himself, wandering aimlessly around. If you ever plan a visit to come out here, just know that you will not find a headstone bearing his name, as he is in an unmarked grave. Now, Billy, he was no saint. And if he was, let's just say that he would be more in the Lucifer category than anything else. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Now, unfortunately, childhood, it was not a happy time for Billy. He and his siblings, they suffer a horrific loss as young children. Billy was only 5. When him and his sister find their mother's lifeless body. Oh, poor things. I just cannot even imagine. So sad. Cause of death was cerebral hemorrhage. And their unstable father, you know, there's a lot of things he could have done. He could have raised them. He could have sent them away to be with family members. He could have dumped them off in an orphanage or foster home. But what he does is kind of like what the people do when they have an animal and they're like fleeing from a hurricane and tie them to the fence. You know, it's like, what are you doing, right? And so Papa Bear, who's not really a Papa Bear, he ends up taking his children and he puts them into an old abandoned mine. And he just leaves them there without a second thought. Wipe his hands clean and he's off and about. Okay. Mm-hmm. Father of the Year award definitely doesn't go to this asshole. So the kids, they're eventually found by authorities. Thank God, and they're placed into foster homes, all but Billy Jr. You see, Billy had this like weird growth on his eye, and when it was surgically removed, it unfortunately caused this permanent droopiness with one of his eyes, making him look very interesting. He stood out, and not in a good way. No home wanted to welcome him in, and he becomes a warden of the state. Now, was it just because of how he looked, or did he have anger issues already? I don't know. All I know is that each one of his siblings, they were placed into good homes, and he was not. So, warden of the state, right? And he starts a life of crime at the tender age of 12 years old. And by 17 years old, he finds himself in the Missouri State Penitentiary. And while he may have been imprisoned there, this did not tame this violent man. He would proceed to beat a fellow inmate quite severely with a baseball bat. How an inmate in a state pen got a baseball bat? Don't know, but it happened. He would say sayonara to Missouri State Pen and move on up to San Quentin, where he would eventually be executed. That was when California was doing the good old death penalties, and he would be killed in the gas chamber. He was only 22 years old, and he would die December 12th of 1952. Findagrave.com talks a little bit more about the reason why this young man was executed. Quote, mass murderer, also known as cockeyed cook, due to a botched operation in his eye to correct a congenital defect, committing numerous murders over a several-week spree, including the Mosser family. After carjacking the family, he forced them to drive to Joplin, Missouri. And at approximately 2 a.m., Cook became alarmed by a passing patrol car and shot all three children, ages 3, 6, and 8, and both parents and their dog, dumping their bodies into a mineshaft in the Chitwood section of town. The bodies, they were recovered during his two-week spree. He also kidnapped and bound an Oklahoma deputy and stole his patrol car. Then he proceeded to kidnap and hold hostage Robert Dewey, forcing him to drive to California. Upon their arrival, Cook killed Dewey. Cook was later recognized by a police chief in Santa Rosaria, California, and captured. After standing trial for the Mosser family murderers and receiving a 300-year sentence, he was tried in California for the Dewey murder, for which he received the death penalty. The penalty was carried out in the gas chamber in San Quentin prison by the California Department of Corrections, unquote. See, like, I know I'm going to piss some people off because not everybody is for the death penalty like I am, and I totally get that and respect that. We should each be able to feel what we want, but my thing is that 300-year sentence. Oh, this guy, he killed like 10 people and he has like 1,000. Dude ain't going to live 1,000 years. He murdered people. He took them away from their spouses, from their children, from their moms and dads and friends and, you know, different things. Sorry, in my opinion, death penalty. Prove their guilt and death penalty. 300 years killing an entire family and their dog? But thankfully, one of the murders took place in California when they were doing the death penalty at the time. So, thankfully, he might have gotten away with a life sentence or 300-year sentence for the death of 5 people and an animal. But that one person in that one state, he got the death penalty. So the Mosser family, they consisted of mother and father, Thelma and Carl, and their children, oldest, remember, 8 years old to youngest, 3 years old, Ronald Dean, Gary Carl, and little Pamela Sue. An entire family and family dog wiped out. MissouriGravestones.org gives more details about some of the victims. Quote, he murdered Robert Dewey, 32 years old, a vacationing salesman in California, who had the misfortune to pick him up as a hitchhiker. Sentenced to death by a California court for this crime, he kidnapped Lee Archer in Texas. He kidnapped Lee Archer in Texas, who escaped from the trunk of the car, kidnapped Deputy Homer Waldron near Blythe, California. Billy let him live because he had worked with Waldrop's wife, Cecilia, and she had been nice to him during that time. He kidnapped James Burke and Forrest Dameron and forced them to drive him over to the Mexican border where he was finally arrested, unquote. This murderous man, mass murderer, spree killer, his last meal consisted of fried chicken, French fried potatoes, pumpkin pie, along with some coffee and milk. Obviously too good of a meal for such a monstrous man. Should have thrown some stale bread at him. Many who've come at night, which, by the way, you might want to check to see if they do the dusk till dawn hours, which a lot of cemeteries tend to do. People have experienced seeing a shadow figure often leaning against a tree. Again, they think it's the mass murderer himself. Folks have also heard things such as laughter, disembodied footsteps, just feeling like a feeling of dread, like they shouldn't be there. And the mysterious light that is seen, well, it's described as a bluish white light, and it's often compared to the Joplin spook light. So,
that concludes another fantastic podcast. Legend has it, if you don't tune in, I'll be returning to haunt you. So make sure to tune in for the next episode.
Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They're all fantastic. Haven't heard every single damn one yet? Well, no need to sleep. No need to lose sleep over it, my friends. Really, you can binge listen to your heart's fright and delight right this very second. Just hit up any of those terrific podcast platforms, such as Radio Public, Overcast, Poddash, Castomatic, Spotify. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers Podcast lurking in the background. So, FYI, my friends, we are getting closer to my favorite holiday, Halloween. You know the drill. I am looking for some fresh blood. Oh, I mean, some blood donors to share a spooky experience, an encounter. Maybe it's one of your favorite investigations, right? A scary story that you grew up hearing about, a local urban legend or myth or something, a favorite local haunt. I want to hear from you, my friends. Paraprowl@gmail.com. That's paraprowl@gmail.com. Please. Hit me up. Thanks, everybody, and I will
see you next week.